Sandpoint, K201DA, King Cove, KFPS, False Pass.
Good morning. On a cold, dark evening over Washington, a military helicopter crashed into a passenger jet landing at Reagan National Airport. Both dropped into the Potomac. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, we ask a pilot and air safety expert how this could have happened. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We also have the latest in President Trump's effort to house migrants with criminal backgrounds at Guantanamo Bay. Plus, parents living in the U.S. without legal status are bracing for immigration officers to take their kids. And we look at the prior criminal records of some of the January 6th defendants pardoned by President Trump. It is Thursday, January 30th. On this day in 1975, Eleanor Rubik applied for a patent for his magic cube invention, which came to be known as the Rubik's Cube. And the news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Officials say there are likely no survivors after an American Airlines passenger jet collided with an Army Black Hawk helicopter on a training mission near Reagan National Airport outside of Washington, D.C. last night as the plane was about to land. Both aircraft plunged into the Potomac River. Both have been found. The plane was found upside down and in three parts. 64 people were on the plane. Three soldiers were on the helicopter. 28 bodies so far have been recovered. Jackson Sinneberg from member station WAMU has more.
Crews from D.C. Fire and EMS, the Coast Guard, Maryland State Police, and more waded into the Potomac's 8-foot-deep, frigid waters throughout the night. Their initial mission to search for and rescue potential survivors became one of recovering bodies and wreckage. Officials say the plane broke into three sections. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia recalled their arrival to the scene.
And while I did not see the collision, I'd never seen this many red lights streaming towards the airport and across the river in Maryland about this time. My phone started blowing up, and I realized that this accident had taken place.
The American Airlines passenger jet was en route from Wichita, Kansas, heading to D.C. Among the passengers were members of the U.S. figure skating community who were attending a skating camp. For NPR News, I'm Jackson Sinnenberg.
Three of President Trump's key cabinet nominees will be on Capitol Hill for Senate confirmation hearings, including Kash Patel, Trump's nominee to head the FBI. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Charles Grassley.
Mr. Patel, I know you know this, but it's your job to restore the public trust and return the FBI to its core mission of fighting crime.
It's an agency Patel has been critical of in the past, telling a podcast that if he was in charge, he would close the FBI headquarters and turn it into a museum to the deep state. Health and Human Services nominee Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will be back for a second day, and Tulsi Gabbard, Director of National Intelligence nominee, will also be on the Hill today. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reports somewhat slower economic growth in the final months of the year. NPR Scott Horsley reports.
The U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of 2.3% in October, November, and December, a modest slowdown from the previous quarter. The growth was largely fueled by robust consumer spending on both goods and services. Business investment was down during the quarter. Economic growth in Europe has been much weaker. The European Central Bank lowered its benchmark interest rate today in an effort to jumpstart economic activity. Here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve is holding interest rates steady. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said Wednesday the central bank is in no hurry to cut interest rates further until it sees more progress on inflation or else signs of weakness in the job market. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. It was days ago that Chinese startup DeepSeek shocked the tech industry with its artificial intelligence model developed far cheaper than those produced by companies such as OpenAI. Now, as NPR's John Ruwish reports, a second company in China says it's done much the same.
The Chinese tech giant Alibaba says it's launched an upgrade to its AI model, and the new version performs better than cutting-edge AIs, including OpenAI's ChatGPT-4 and Meta's Llama. The news comes on the heels of a stock market meltdown after DeepSeek unveiled an advanced AI model that it claims was made cheaply and with fewer and lower performance microchips than others. Many in the industry were surprised by DeepSeek, believing that companies in China were further behind the leading American AI firms. Alibaba's cloud computing unit says its new model comprehensively outperformed DeepSeek's V3 large language model and the others. NPR has not verified the claim. John Ruich, NPR News.
A mountain in New Zealand has been recognized as a legal person with all the rights and responsibilities of a human being. Mount Taranaki, now known as Taranaki Maunga, is considered an ancestor of the Maori indigenous people. The legal recognition acknowledges the mountain's theft from the Maori people after New Zealand was colonized. The pristine snow-capped dormant volcano is the second highest on New Zealand's North Island, and it's a popular spot for tourists, hiking, and also snow sports. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's work through what we know and also what our sources are about a mid-air collision over the Potomac. As with any breaking story, you're going to hear a lot of stuff. We will try to stick to the facts here. An American Eagle flight from Wichita had 64 people on board last evening when it collided over the Potomac River with a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter that had three on board. DC Fire now says no survivors, the fire department from Washington, D.C. U.S. Department of Transportation says both aircraft were doing standard things and standard patterns of flight. U.S. Figure Skating says some of their athletes, coaches, and families were on board coming from an event in Wichita, Kansas. And the Kremlin says Russian skaters were on board, too. NPR's Frank Langfitt is our source for further information. He is at Washington's Reagan National Airport, where there was a briefing earlier today. And Frank, what jumped out for you?
Well, I think the key thing for me was this question that came up, Steve, from the American Airlines CEO, Robert Isom. He, referring to the American Airlines, the American Eagle Flight 5342, he said this.
It collided with a military aircraft on an otherwise normal approach. And at this time, we don't know why the military aircraft came into the path of the PSA aircraft.
A PSA, by the way, is a subsidiary of American. But what Isom is getting at is this video that I think many people have seen. It was a clear night, and it appears to show the helicopter heading into the flight path of jet. And then there's a bright light and a big explosion. And after that, of course, both aircraft falling into the Potomac, which, you know, had a lot of ice in it.
Now, the way that Isom phrases that suggests that he believes the American Airlines, the American Eagle flight, was on its normal pattern heading into runway 33, and that the helicopter was where it wasn't. I guess we need to reserve judgment on that. We'll see what investigators find. But that is the question. Why would two aircraft in normal flights that were in contact, apparently, with air traffic control end up in exactly the same spot over the Potomac River? I understand we're also hearing something today from the Defense Secretary about the Army helicopter. Frank, what do you got?
You know, what he's saying is that this was a fairly experienced crew, and it was on a proficiency exercise, a night evaluation, and that they were using night vision goggles. But we don't know much more than that. And again, I think you're making an excellent point. These investigations take many, many months. They go on for a long time. It's just the morning after, so it will take a long time to find out exactly what caused this.
And I suppose, knowing what you know about the Potomac River, it is, I'm sad to say, no surprise that there would be no survivors after this plane ended up upside down in the water.
Yeah, it's been very cold here in the Washington, D.C. area for quite some time, and there's been ice on the river and elsewhere. And so apparently the plane broke into three parts, turned upside down, is in about waist-deep water.
And again, the total death toll, we don't have all the bodies recovered. We're told there were something like 28 bodies recovered as of earlier this morning, but the total death toll includes 60 passengers, four crew on the American Eagle flight, and three U.S. Army personnel on board that Black Hawk helicopter. Frank, thanks so much.
Good to talk, Steve.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt at Washington National Airport, Reagan National Airport, and we'll continue to bring you more as we learn it.
President Trump says he plans to use a migrant holding facility at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to house up to 30,000 migrants deported from the United States.
The president brought this up at a bill signing event. His notion was to detain what he called, quote, the worst criminal illegal aliens. Reusing the famous base is an idea that Trump brought up before his first presidential term, but he never did it. His Homeland Security Secretary acknowledges the administration would need an act of Congress to spend money on the idea now.
NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has been covering Guantanamo Bay for years, and she's here with us in our studios in Washington, D.C. to tell us more about this latest development. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So, Sasha, look, I think most people, when they hear Guantanamo, they think of a prison for suspected foreign terrorists. Like, this is where the alleged 9/11 mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, is held. So are we talking about the same place?
We are not. The Trump administration is saying that migrants would not be in that U.S. military prison detention facility where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is held. They would instead be on the naval base portion of Guantanamo, which is a separate area. And for decades, the naval base has had a detention facility that houses migrants intercepted at sea. They're usually Haitian or Cuban or Dominican. It's been mostly empty for years. So Trump is saying he wants to expand that migrant detention facility to make room for deported migrants.
So once there, how long would migrants be held there?
This came up on Fox News, where the Trump administration basically broke this news yesterday. Fox had on Pete Hegseth, the new defense secretary, and Hegseth said the plan is not to hold these migrants indefinitely. Indefinite detention is what is happening at the military prison. Some people there have been held for two decades, more than two decades, without being charged. But Hegseth says when it comes to deported migrants, Guantanamo would be a way station, as he called it, until the administration finds other countries to take them. Here he is on Fox.
This is not the camps. You're not putting criminals right in camps where ISIS and other criminals. This is a temporary transit where we can plus up thousands and tens of thousands if necessary to humanely move illegals out of our country where they do not belong back to the countries where they came from in proper process.
But Michelle, details are very thin so far, and the Trump administration has not said how it would define what Hegseth called temporary transit.
Does the existing migrant holding facility at Guantanamo actually have 30,000 beds?
Unclear. When Trump first announced this, he said it did, but he later said he plans to expand the facility to full capacity. I spoke about this with the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Vince Warren, and he said this about the current status of Guantanamo's migrant detention operation.
There haven't been 30,000 beds in decades. The facility is decrepit. It's been falling apart. It's in disrepair.
He told me he knows that through reports from migrants who've been there. Defense Secretary Hegseth also said a golf course on the naval base would have room for 6,000 deported migrants. So the administration seems to be trying to identify different spaces at Guantanamo that could have room for tens of thousands of people.
And before we let you go, holding prisoners at Guantanamo has been very expensive over the years. Do we know how much this would cost and where this money would come from?
The administration did not give a dollar figure, but you're right. The plan would require construction, food, lodging for people, held there. Guards are staffed to oversee it, money to transport migrants there. Because Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, said the migrants would be flown there directly. So on cost, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said only that money would be appropriated by Congress for that. She also said ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, would run the facility. As for when migrants might start being flown there, they didn't say. There'll certainly be a lot of litigation about this.
That is NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer. Sasha, thank you.
You're welcome.
After losing power in Washington, Democrats vote this weekend on a new party leader who they hope will help them win it back. Here's NPR's Stephen Fowler.
For about 8 hours in a hotel ballroom in snowy Detroit earlier this month, the future of the Democratic Party, or at least the Democratic National Committee, was front and center.
As we consider the next 4 years, Americans will look to the voices of our chair, vice chairs, treasurer, secretary, and national finance chair to hold the Trump administration accountable.
That's current DNC chair Jamie Harrison, who isn't running for a second term, kicking off a forum for candidates seeking to serve as an officer of the DNC. Because Democrats were on the losing end of key national races in November, figuring out what went wrong in 2024 and how to make changes as a result will be one of the first jobs for new leadership. But they're not starting from scratch. Harrison says the party has built up its infrastructure and data over the years to be equipped for future campaigns, especially at the state level.
No DNC has ever invested more resources into strengthening our state parties than this DNC.
At this forum and others held virtually in January, activists and party leaders from across the country and across the ideological spectrum have largely shared the same ideas for how the party should course correct. That includes the two leading candidates for chair, who both currently lead state parties in the Midwest, and both say Democrats need year-round organizing and better messaging to take on Trump's second term.
My job is to get out there and define the Republicans. I will take the low road so they can take the high road. I will throw the punches so they don't have to.
Minnesota's Ken Martin says as chair he'd go on offense while the party uses its deep bench of elected officials to share what Democrats stand for. Wisconsin's Ben Wickler envisions a Democratic Party that wins back voters by focusing their fight on issues that are most tangible, like health care and education, and would be a behind-the-scenes cheerleader.
Our candidates are the people who carry the message to voters. A DNC chair needs to energize volunteers, needs to inspire people to run for office, needs to inspire people to donate, needs to lift people up. Then we need to mobilize.
Hashing out strategies for organizing and fundraising are important, long-shot presidential candidate turned long-shot DNC chair candidate Marianne Williamson says. But there's also the looming urgency of Trump back in power that Democrats need to reckon with.
We're dealing with Donald Trump. He is not an ordinary politician. Ordinary politics will not be enough to take this on.
Without control of the White House or majorities in either chamber of Congress, the new chair will be one of many faces of the Democratic Party that's still figuring out how to move on from rejection at the ballot box in November. A final candidate forum is Thursday night before the 448 voting members of the DNC hold their election on Saturday. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air. How Louis Armstrong became the first Black pop star and musician who provided the foundational language of improvisation. We talk with Ricky Riccardi, author of Stomp Off, Let's Go, The Early Years of Louis Armstrong. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The Trump administration says it's made more than 5,000 immigration arrests over the past week. Keep that up for a year, it'd be something more than 250,000. And some people are asking what they might do if authorities come for them. During his first term, Trump separated thousands of children from parents or relatives who were apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border. In the U.S. right now, more than 4 million American children who were born here live with a parent who lacks legal status. Chip Mitchell of member station WBEZ got to know a family on Chicago's north side.
After 7 months of breastfeeding, Damaris Posadas' baby is good and chubby.
I breastfeed him when I'm with him, and at work I pump, and we're hoping to do that at least until he's 2 years old.
She says it's not only for nutrition.
It just provides that bonding experience, which I'm very grateful for.
Damaris was born in Mexico. She speaks Spanish to the baby.
Hola, mi amor. ¿Qué es eso?
He hears a different language from his dad. His name's Métis.
Long? Apaklong name? Apaklong name?
Métis asked that his last name be withheld because he and his wife don't have legal status. He's speaking Thai, the official language of Thailand, where he was born.
Found out he can now be tickled, like, manually instead of just by raspberries.
Damaris and Métis, by coincidence, they both arrived in the U.S. at age 3. They grew up in Chicago. They met in high school and started dating more than a decade ago. They both qualified for an Obama-era program known as DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It shields 500,000 young people from deportation. Damaris and Métis both have master's degrees. DACA enables them to work legally, and they both have good jobs. She's a Catholic high school teacher. He's a software developer and works from home with the baby. They rent a two-bedroom apartment in a diverse neighborhood on Chicago's north side. In a walk-in closet, they have a changing table for the baby.
It's a crib. It's a crib. It was our first crib, but he kept smacking his head on the slide in his sleep.
They have fun with the baby, but life for Damaris and Métis in the United States, the only country they know, it's always seemed precarious. During Donald Trump's first presidency, he tried to end DACA. Their stress levels soared again as Trump campaigned last year.
We will begin the largest domestic deportation operation in American history. We have no choice.
Now the arrests have begun. Trump's administration says it's targeting public safety threats, but his Border Czar says the arrests have already gone beyond those targets, and there's no promise to protect DACA recipients. Trump has sent mixed messages on the program. That has Damaris and Métis worried about the possibility of being separated from their son, a U.S. citizen. Worries like that are nothing new to Damaris. As a 3-year-old, her first solid memory was an overnight hike in the desert with her mom and a bunch of strangers.
I remember heavy darkness, just pitch black all around, and it was cold. It was freezing.
They were crossing the border into Texas. Damaris says she must have been making noise because this one guy, he was worried about U.S. Border Patrol agents. He confronted Damaris's mom,
saying, "You need to shut her up. You can't have her screaming." So she was just trying to calm me down. And then the next thing I remember is that he was coming over to me with tape. They were about to just tape my mouth shut.
They made it across the border and found their way to Chicago. Damaris grew up in Little Village, a neighborhood full of families with Mexico roots. She made it into one of Illinois' highest-ranked high schools. But without legal status to be in the country, life was rough. When she was 17, federal immigration agents arrived at her family's house. She says one pointed a gun at her head. They took away her stepfather. After his deportation, he tried crossing back in from Mexico.
He had a cell phone that we had given him, and the cell phone was still receiving calls, so we're calling that cell phone just every day, and at one point it stops ringing. And that's the last I've ever heard of him. We can assume he died.
Damaris says she doesn't want to go through anything like that again. University of Illinois law professor Lauren Aronson says it's conceivable Trump would separate children from parents.
I don't put anything past them, given, you know, history.
The history of Trump's first administration separating kids from families at the border. Damaris and Métis say they're planning ways to keep their family intact. Mexican officials urge immigrant parents to get dual citizenship for their children born in the U.S. to make sure, if the parents are deported, the kids don't end up lost in the U.S. child welfare system. Damaris and Métis are keeping their baby with them around the clock. No sitters or childcare ever. They're going over every possible scenario for immigration agents taking one or both of them, and which one first. And they're working through a list of stuff to get done. Finances, phone service, what to do with furniture.
Like these couches, like maybe they can live in a storage unit here for a couple years until I can get them over.
The plan, ultimately, is to settle in Thailand. So this month they got Thai citizenship for the baby. They've applied for his Thai passport. But while Métis would be deported to Thailand, Damaris would be deported to Mexico. They want the baby to stay with her, so they strategize. The baby needs citizenship for all three countries, and passports, too. The stress hits Damaris hardest at night, after she wakes up to feed the baby.
Sometimes having thoughts run cyclically in my head, and then I just end up staying up for hours, and then he's awake again.
The same thoughts, over and over, like if she's separated from the baby, will he take to formula?
And then also, will he remember me? I mean, he's 7 months old, right? Like, if I'm gone for a month, let's say, because we're trying to get me to Thailand somehow, and it's just a hard thing to do, when I see him again, is he still going to hug me? Is he still going to smile when he sees me? Is he going to give me that little gummy smile? Is there going to be a tooth in that smile now that I missed? I mean, I don't want to think about these things, but I do.
This week, Damaris says she's seeing whether her employer can sponsor a work visa or permanent residence. It's one more thing on her deportation to-do list. For NPR News, I'm Chip Mitchell in Chicago.
This is NPR News.
Boston Mayor Michelle Wu is the city's first mayor to give birth while in office. Now she's back at City Hall with her newborn in tow.
Mira held her own. She participated in a cabinet meeting, had one diaper issue that we needed to address, but it got taken care of pretty quickly.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Authorities say they don't expect to find any survivors of last night's mid-air collision of an American Airlines regional jet and a military helicopter near Washington, D.C. They collided as Flight 5342 from Wichita was attempting to land at Reagan National Airport, sending both aircraft into the Potomac River. More than two dozen bodies have been recovered, including one from the U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter. The CEO of American Airlines says the collision occurred on an otherwise normal approach for the passenger plane. Lily Wu is the mayor of Wichita.
Our community needs to come together to support the family members who have been impacted, to come together in honor of those individuals on that flight.
The Black Hawk was on a training flight at the time. Divers remain in the river with water temperatures in the 30s and 40s. The White House says President Trump plans to make remarks about last night's plane crash next hour. The Commerce Department says growth in the U.S. economy slowed in the final months of 2024. Gross domestic product rose at an annual pace of 2.3% in the fourth quarter. That's down from an annual pace of 3.1% in the previous quarter. The numbers come a day after the Federal Reserve left interest rates unchanged. This is NPR News. Hamas has released eight more hostages as part of a ceasefire agreement with Israel. Three of the hostages are Israeli. Before the end of the day, Israel is expected to release 110 Palestinian prisoners and detainees in line with that agreement. In India, the government is ordering an investigation into yesterday's stampede that left dozens of people dead at a Hindu religious gathering. As NPR's Omar Kamdekar reports, opposition parties are accusing authorities of mismanagement by prioritizing access for VIPs.
Critics say it's unlikely that a government investigation into the stampede will produce any accountability, because it's being conducted by the same authorities who were meant to ensure safety during the religious gathering. The stampede occurred during the Mahakumbh, when millions of devotees bathe in the confluence of two sacred rivers, Yamuna and the Ganges. Some witnesses told local media that the stampede began when people fell on each other. Others said the closure of several entry routes led to bottlenecks, causing worshippers to faint and fall from suffocation. The Mahakumbh is a six-week Hindu religious gathering held once every 12 years. It draws hundreds of millions from across India. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
Stocks on Wall Street are mostly higher. The Dow is up 51 points. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We do not know why two aircraft ended up at the very same point in the sky at the very same time over the Potomac River last night. We do know that it happened in a crowded airspace in the area of Washington, D.C., where there are three major commercial airports as well as military bases, many military flights. One plane was an American Eagle jet. The other plane was a U.S. Army Black Hawk. Earlier today, we spoke with Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, who said that congestion has been part of the debate about that airport and the surrounding area.
This is an airport, as you know, Steve. It's on a pretty tiny footprint, and it was originally built with the thought that these runways could handle about 15 million passengers in and out a year. The number of passengers in and out of Reagan National is now well in excess of 20 million a year. Mm-hmm. And so those of us who represent the region have often tried to make the case that, listen, we've got a couple of other airports here. Let's spread the traffic out among the airports, because this congestion issue has been a concern.
Until that congestion is fixed, it's up to air traffic controllers, federal employees who work for the Federal Aviation Administration, to keep the planes apart and the helicopters apart. And our understanding is that they were in touch with both aircraft last evening. Let's bring in Randy Babbitt, who has some insights about this. He is a former administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration and also a former commercial airline pilot. Mr. Babbitt, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us on a tragic day. I understand you are familiar with the approach that the American Eagle flight was taking last night. What is that like?
Yes, it's a relatively straight-in approach. If you're landing on 1-8, they did shift them over. Excuse me, they were landing, cleared to land on the north runway.
3-3, I think, is right.
They moved them over to a crossing runway, probably to expedite departures or something. And that's, again, a rather routine. It happens at these airports sometimes, for air traffic and other reasons. They'll move you to another runway, and that's what was in progress.
You just told me something that is a little bit new to me. It is your understanding, Mr. Babbitt, that they changed the runway. They were both roughly north-south runways, but one of them is at a bit of an angle, and I guess that means that the plane itself would change slightly exactly where it was over the Potomac on its way in. Is that right?
Well, what he would do, no, if you extend the center line of the runway out, he would have to move over. That aircraft would move over probably a quarter of a mile to the east to line up with the other runway, which is a heading of 330 degrees. The runway they were originally going to land on was 360. So it's about a 30-degree difference of the direction of the runway.
Okay. Is that a question you would ask as to whether perhaps the helicopter thought this plane should be in a different place than it was because of this change?
Anything we do at this point, unfortunately, is speculation.
Right.
Yes. There's another possibility. The helicopter, as I understand it and have listened to the tapes, indicated he did, in fact, see the other aircraft. But the question that comes to mind a lot of times is, did you see the aircraft? Did you see an aircraft, or was it the aircraft they were asking you about? And that'll come out. I mean, we're going to have this. Lots of speculation, but fortunately we have good investigators at both the FAA and the NTSB that'll look into this thoroughly to see if they're going to determine what happened. And
Mr. Babbitt, I got a pit in my stomach when you're talking, because on the video that we have seen, apparently of the explosion as the aircraft strike, there's another airplane visible up in the sky there. So we don't know when they said, yes, I see the plane. We don't know for sure if they saw the correct plane.
That's exactly what I've seen the same video, and they typically will ask you in visual conditions, do you see in this case the American Eagle jet? And if the pilot says yes, I see them, well then the controller has every right to believe that okay, we're all good. And if the mistake was in, but we don't know. It's pure speculation.
Yeah,
but
yeah, and we should be clear about that. We're gathering information rather than reaching conclusions here. It was night. We presume that would make the other airplane a little harder to identify, although we're also told there would have been night vision goggles. This was a night mission by the helicopter, and we can't even say who's at fault at this point. But Randy Babbitt, former administrator of the FAA and former commercial airline pilot, thanks for your insights. I really appreciate what you had to say this morning.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you. Enjoy.
And we'll continue to bring you more as we learn it. 64 people on board the American Eagle flight, 3 on the Army Black Hawk, all believed dead. President Trump backed off a memo calling to pause trillions of dollars in payments to Americans, but an order to suspend foreign aid remains in effect. And people feeling that include some in Afghanistan. Here's NPR's Dia Hadid.
Last week, the State Department effectively froze USAID-funded projects around the world while a review takes place to see if they align with the new administration's agenda. Emergency food aid was exempted. Days later, the Afghan Deputy Economic Minister said around 50 charities had partially suspended or halted their work. The Deputy Minister, Abdullatif Nazari, said those charities were providing humanitarian aid, healthcare and education. This comes at a tough time. About 15 million people, a third of all Afghans, mostly women and children, are malnourished, even starving. The World Food Programme only had enough money last year to help less than half those people, and much of their funding comes from the US. It's not clear how much of that money can still be spent. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has signed a memo saying projects that delivered life-saving humanitarian assistance would be exempted from the suspension. But one official told NPR that for now, most USAID work in Afghanistan is still suspended. Amid the uncertainty in Afghan bazaars, the prices of items like bread, flour, cooking oil and rice have been rising. It's created hardship to folks who are barely getting by, like 48-year-old Iklima. She asks we only use her first name. She's worried the Taliban will identify her. She says items she could once afford are now out of reach, like a gallon of cooking oil. The price has increased by $5. It's a lot of money in Afghanistan. She purchased a new wood heater a few months ago. Now she can't afford firewood. She says, we can only afford to breathe. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai, with Fazl Minallah Kazizai in Kabul and Fariba Akbari in Paris.
This is NPR News.
Some Harvard students have modified smart glasses that can identify people just by looking at their faces. What's it all mean for privacy? Next time here and now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. When Iris Cummings Critchell died earlier this week at the age of 104, she left behind a one-of-a-kind legacy. She was a U.S. Olympic swimmer, the last survivor of the 1936 team that competed in Hitler's Germany. Then she traded the pool for the sky. She flew bombers as part of the elite Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or WASP, during World War II. After the war, she taught aviation at universities. By the time she retired, she'd spent 76 years in the air. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We are learning new information this morning about the lengthy criminal records of dozens of January 6th defendants who received pardons from President Trump.
Yeah, the president gave blanket clemency to all January 6th defendants, regardless of whether they violently assaulted police on that day. People got clemency for January 6th, even when they had criminal records for other offenses on other dates, such as rape, sexual abuse, and domestic violence.
NPR investigative correspondent Tom Dreisbach has been digging into the court records. He's here to tell us more about this. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
So what kinds of cases did you identify?
Well, many January 6th defendants had no criminal records at all, but we found dozens of cases where people had a significant criminal history. One example that really sticks out is the case of Matthew Huddle. He pleaded guilty to entering and remaining in the Capitol, and he also had a lengthy criminal record, including for drunk driving. And there's one incident that I should say people listening might find disturbing. Prosecutors said, quote, Huddle spanked his three-year-old son so hard that he left bruises all over the child's backside and the child's neck, and the child had such extreme pain on his backside that he could not sit properly for a week. Then even after Huddle took part in the Capitol riot, he continued to rack up charges for driving offenses in Indiana. And just a few days after Trump pardoned him for his January 6th case, he actually just got pulled over again by police in Indiana. We don't have a lot of details. It is under investigation. But we know a sheriff's deputy shot and killed him during an altercation.
So how did these criminal records, or did these criminal records, affect the January 6th cases?
Well, federal judges always factor in defendants' criminal history when they decide on a sentence. One example, defendant was Peter Schwartz. Court records indicate he had 38 criminal convictions before he assaulted police with pepper spray on January 6th. And that's one reason he got a really lengthy sentence, 14 years in prison for his January 6th charges. And then Trump pardoned him, so he obviously did not finish that prison sentence. Trump has said, in general, these defendants got sentences that were too long, but the White House did not make any distinction between people who had a criminal record and those who did not.
And I know that Trump has been asked about this, so what has he said about the decision to give clemency to all of the January 6th defendants?
Well, I reached out to the White House. They did not respond, but Trump has made some comments recently on Fox News where he seemed to say that it would have just been too difficult to evaluate all of the January 6th charges individually.
Most of the people were absolutely innocent. Okay, but forgetting all about that, these people have served horribly a long time. It would be very, very cumbersome to go and look. You know how many people we're talking about? 1,500 people. Almost all of them should not have happened.
Now, Trump's pardons only apply to the January 6th charges. So are some people still facing some legal consequences for other cases?
Yes. There's an example from a January 6th defendant named Theodore Middendorf. He separately pleaded guilty to sexual abuse of a 7-year-old child. He is still facing a lengthy prison sentence in Illinois on that case. Another defendant, David Daniel, is facing allegations that he sexually abused 2 young girls in his family and possessed child sexual abuse images. He has pleaded not guilty. That case is ongoing.
That is NPR's Tom Dreisbach. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
personal look at trying to recover from a fire.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Glassdoor. Adam Grant has joined the Glassdoor community with expert advice on finding a job and making the most of work life. Learn more at glassdoor.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishour, in for David Brancaccio. First, the economy. The U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of 2.3% in the fourth quarter. That is actually a slowdown from the quarter before and less than many economists were expecting, but still growth. Diane Swonk is chief economist at the audit, tax, and advisory firm KPMG.
We saw consumer spending actually accelerate in the fourth quarter at the fastest pace in quite a while, even though consumers' attitudes about the economy actually soured. We've seen this continuing dissonance between how people feel about the economy and how it adds up on paper.
Why do you think that dissonance exists?
There's really two simple answers to that. The first is the economic aggregates are just being driven. The spending gains are being driven by the highest income households. Income inequalities and wealth inequalities have risen, and that is a real factor that gets masked by the economic aggregates. The second issue is that 67% of our labor force was born in 1982 or later. They never experienced inflation, and 100% of the economy feels the level of prices today, and that is leaving people disappointed in the economy, even though their wages are currently outpacing the pace at which prices are going up.
Diane Swonk at KPMG. All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is up 119 points. That is 0.3%. The S&P 500 is up 0.1%. The NASDAQ is down 0.3%. And the yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.529%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, aiming to help save time by offering smart business buying solutions so there's more time to focus on growing the business and less time doing the admin. More at AmazonBusiness.com. And by Rubrik, dedicated to giving businesses the power to bounce back fast when cyber attacks target the cloud. More at Rubrik.com. And by Affinity, provider of the CRM for the private capital relationship economy. Affinity knows who has the best relationship with the right startup. Affinity.co/marketplace.
The Southern California fires this month destroyed at least 16,000 structures, 9,000 of them in and around the town of Altadena, about a half hour northeast of downtown Los Angeles. They were mostly homes, and one of them was my colleague David Brancaccio's. He and Mary Brancaccio had owned the place for just 2 months and one day before it was gone. We thought what they're learning through all of this might be useful to others.
Until this moment, we'd only seen photos.
Oh, it's hard to look at.
The footprint of what was an 1,100-square-foot two-bedroom cottage is now a pond of fluffy ash, marshmallow-sized lumps of black char, and a chimney. What's that?
The post box. Oh, the mail inside it burned up. Oh, it's all just ashes. Who knows what it was?
The deed to the house?
Yeah.
The house on the left, the house on the right, also flattened. Now, we get others have it worse. We have some insurance, hopefully. Our kids are all self-sufficient adults living elsewhere. And since we only moved in before Thanksgiving, many irreplaceable things were being boxed for transit, but not here yet. But among the things that were here was a copper flask of water I got from the mouth of the sacred Ganges River while reporting from the Himalayas years ago. We placed it right here. So there was a mantle here over the fireplace. That's all burned up. So what I'm looking for is not going to be here. If we can get the money together, among the many questions keeping me awake is where are we going to find a builder? 16,000 places burned here this month. And I know that replacing them will create enormous new demand up against limited supply for contractors. Then I learned the reality of that business.
Most people are remodelers.
Waleed Dilawari is a contractor and developer who does know how to build from the ground up and has been sharing what he knows.
Surprisingly, most contractors don't know the new construction side of it or the understanding of how to build with scale.
Scale, meaning someone with the skills to spin the plates on several builds at the same time, because I should rest assured, any contractor interested in my modest job will be multitasking.
If they're helping one or two or three people in your neighborhood, making sure that they have the know-how to build that large of a property with that many people.
Dilawari had to flee his Altadena home with his wife and kids when he saw the hillside go red. He will rebuild, but even a person of this skill, mortgage broker turned contractor and developer, doesn't know what it'll cost.
I just found out my slab is broken, so I have to pull that out. That price per square footage is going to easily change.
To get a long view from a wildfire survivor, I turned to Jeff Chemnick, who runs a nursery and private garden in Santa Barbara. You know the aloe plant? His place is called Aloes in Wonderland. His house was one of 220 lost in a fire 16 years ago, and he rebuilt something more fire hardy in what's seen as record time.
2 years, almost to the day.
That stopped me. 2 years is fast. Jeff is a botanist who'd been a contractor, which helped him network for a builder. Again, the goal is good contractor.
Sadly, several of our friends sort of fell for the smoke and mirrors of contractors from out of town that promised new building techniques, cheaper prices. And price is certainly a consideration, but should not be your primary driver.
Did they end up with a house in the end, a deficient house, or did they really get scammed and didn't end up with a house?
Well, one of them, the contractor that he engaged, is in prison.
Meanwhile, back at the property, we need power in so many ways.
I look around and now all I see is all the hard work it's going to take to bring it back. And I'm wondering if I still have it in me to do it, if I'm still young enough to do it.
Who do you blame? The infernal wind? Climate change? Some neighbors are suing the electric company that kept its transmission lines energized near the apparent origin of the fire. Oh, and that copper vessel with the sacred water to bless the house at Thanksgiving? I spot it, covered in carbon, empty but recognizable. I don't see the top, but I see the rest of it here.
We'll have the second half of that story tomorrow. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM American Public Media.